Thank you very much to Nathan and to all of you for allowing me to speak. I had a mysterious upper respiratory ailment that wasn't COVID a week or so ago. So my voice is still recovering. So I hope it will last for the whole thing and not sound too terrible by the end. Looking at this section of Luke, sometimes you think that Jesus sounds like the sort of person that you would like running a project for you. Maybe I'm speaking too much as a Canberran, but someone who, will get the job done, who will bring it in on time and under budget and on schedule. Like when you go back to Luke 14 and Jesus talks about the costs of discipleship. For which of you, he says, intending to build a tower, doesn't first sit down and estimate the cost to see whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he's laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who will see it will begin to ridicule him. At other times, Jesus seems a little bit more vague, and just after the section that we read this morning, he's confronted by the Pharisees and he says in response something very abstract. The kingdom of God is not coming with things that can be observed, which isn't very helpful. Nor will people be able to say, look, here it is, or there it is. For in fact, the kingdom of God is among you. And I can imagine the Pharisees scratching their heads and saying, what does he mean, among you? What does he mean by that? And that doesn't really answer the question we were asking about when. When will the kingdom of God arrive? So right through this chapter of Luke 17, Jesus is challenging the way we look at the world, the way we measure progress or we recognize success or assess potential. After all, it was just in the last week's readings that Jesus said faith might be as small as a mustard seed, or as ordinary, our expression of faith as ordinary as serving up dinner. And then we have in this passage the story of the 10 lepers, which continues to challenge our understanding of faith, revealing that God is active and the kingdom of God is found in unlikely places and situations and people. It would be very hard to find a less likely place in the thinking of the people of this time than where Jesus and his disciples were at, as the passage begins, going through the region between Samaria and Galilee. Now, if you were a good Jew, Galilee was bad enough. You might remember the crowds in John's gospel saying, surely the Messiah doesn't come from Galilee. But Samaria was worse. Samaritans in Judean eyes were ethnically compromised. They were the descendants of the northern tribes of Israel and other Mesopotamian peoples that were transplanted to that region by the conquering Assyrian Empire. And their religious traditions, though not vastly different, were regarded as suspect as well. So it's on this border country, this region between Samaria and Galilee, where tension was particularly rife. In 128 BCE, the Judeans had attacked the Samaritan sanctuary at Mount Gerizim. And in Jesus' day, the hostilities were still strong enough that Galileans traveling to Jerusalem often bypassed Samaria altogether, even though this added considerable time to their journey. If you go back to Luke 9, to the start of Jesus making his way toward Jerusalem, you find a Samaritan village which refuses to receive him because of where he's headed. And James and John ask if divine power could just firebomb the village there and then. But the writer of Luke is telling us here to take note of where they are, to take another look at this place, and to recognize that this region between two undesirable places is a place where God is active. We're also being told to take another look at this situation. As Jesus entered the village, it says in verse 12, 10 lepers approached him. They might not have had Hansen's disease, as we know leprosy today, but perhaps suffered from a range of skin diseases assumed to be contagious. This meant that they were separated from their community and forced to fend for themselves. So as outcasts and as beggars and scavengers, they were not regarded very highly. But they know the rules. They keep their distance and they call out to Jesus for mercy. And Jesus responds. Jesus also obeys the rules. He doesn't come near them or touch them, but he says, go and show yourselves to the priests, the priests who can declare them clean and healed. And the lepers go, and as they go, they are healed. The kingdom of God is clearly present in this situation. 10 lepers are healed. But something in the narrative tells us that this is more than just a story about healing, that what happens after the healing is possibly even more significant. Because in verse 15, then one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God with a loud voice. He prostrated himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him. And he, the text says, was a Samaritan. And just in case we miss this fact that it's the Samaritan who turns back, Jesus mentions it again. And were not 10 made clean? Was none of them found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner? Now, I've done a terrible thing. I've put the box over the foreigner. But if you if you move the box of people on your screen, if it's not where it is on my screen, you might see the Samaritan turning back. To rub the salt in, as commentator William Loder says, Luke has Jesus announce that this 10th leper, this Samaritan, this foreigner, has been made whole. An image of full salvation. Get up and go on your way, says Jesus. Your faith has made you well. It is the Samaritan who demonstrates true faith, who turns back, who gives God the glory, who gives thanks. It is the Samaritan, an unlikely person in an unlikely situation, in an unlikely place, who recognizes where God is active and recognizes the kingdom of God in their midst. So the story is deliberately subversive. This despised Samaritan, this despised leper becomes, in Loder's words, our high priest, as it were, or our model of salvation. And those who belong get it wrong. A simple but disturbing story that lives itself out in every generation. How does the story live itself out in our generation, in our experience? Hopefully, It's not always that those who belong get it wrong, though sometimes it is. But it's certainly still those people who we might not expect to become our model of salvation. And perhaps that's something that we could talk about in the breakout groups afterwards. I've been thinking about a woman who was living near our church here for some time, and she suffered from quite terrible depression, and she was a recovering alcoholic, but she was volunteering in a lot of our programs. She's now moved away and lives in Sydney. But she'd always say to me, "Belinda, I'm not religious. I'm not a person of faith. I just like to help out. I like to be part of what you're doing." And a few months ago when she was in hospital, I went to visit her and she introduced me to one of the nurses who came in, and she said, "This is Belinda. She's the minister at the church where I help out, but I am not a person of faith." And the nurse said to her, "Isn't that what faith is? Doing, not just believing? Aren't you on the way?" And we had this lovely conversation between the three of us about what faith actually looked like in people's lives. And I realized that my friend was a model of salvation, that she was someone turning back like that Samaritan to genuinely live out of faith that she just couldn't articulate that she was part of, perhaps yet. And I'm sure that you can think of examples as well, and I'd love to hear if there's things that come to mind in the breakout groups afterwards. It's really good to think about how people around us, and perhaps how each one of us, are models of salvation for each other. As I was thinking about this, I was reminded of a very old episode of Grand Designs Abroad. Does anyone remember ever having watched that, Grand Designs Abroad? It was a spin-off from, you know, the main program, and it followed the adventures of these English couples who decided that, you know, doing these crazy builds with crazy deadlines and crazy budgets in a place where they actually spoke the language was far too easy. So they were going to do it overseas. Anyway, this episode followed a couple who had bought the ruin of a 1,000-year-old hilltop castle in Tuscany, which had been bombed by the Germans and almost totally destroyed by subsequent earthquakes, which they, despite the efforts of the Italian bureaucracy, managed to restore. And what struck me the most about this episode was this insanely passionate determination of the husband, who excavated meters and meters of stone by hand to put back the stones in places where they'd originally stood, and the keystones and the springers and the archways and the stone lintels and the loggia edgings. And as he was doing this, all the residents of the village around, who were initially really unhappy about English people coming and buying the castle, began to delight in this restoration they could see happening. And they began to return stones that they had liberated over the years, or their parents or their grandparents had liberated. And this slightly mad Englishman, which I think is a prerequisite for appearing on Grand Designs, was able to look at this pile of rubble and see the value of each stone, to see what was going to take shape in their midst. And I think maybe that's a good picture for us of God looking at the unlikely places and the unlikely situations and the unlikely people, and seeing the kingdom of God there taking place among us. And I think it's helpful to think about ourselves and who we are in all of this. What is our stone that we bring to what is being built here? Just like those villagers who, seeing the work going on in the castle, suddenly remembered that the wall Dad had built along the back of the yard or the large pavers in the courtyard belonged up there on the hill. We're challenged to bring what we have, to bring our lives to where God is building the kingdom, to where God is active, because we are part of what is happening. The kingdom of God is made up of stones from unlikely places and situations and people, and we are represented. We are part of that building and part of the kingdom of God.